is the Tuesday, August 19th meeting of the Blue Ribbon Commission, held in room 112 of the State Capitol Building in Juneau.
Well, job, I would put down, you feel all alone and lonely over there?
I'll be happy to move over there and sit by if you want to balance that table off.
Yeah, so you don't keep banging this table on me.
All right, I'll do that.
See what happens? That worked out real good.
All that attention, it got you some.
Maybe I can crib off the first senator.
4-4 is 8, we have a quorum, right?
We've got 8, yes.
Okay, call the commission to order. We're on the personnel rules, 39-25-140. Now, we've seen after the discussion, there was some interest in changing E, making an E and an F.
Does everyone have a copy? I have 2 more copies of the memo.
We change the wording around the rules adopted under this chapter that relate to the internal management of state agency only are not subject to the Administrative Procedures Act, and then make an F that says that those that deal with public policy are. It would seem to me that that would give you more latitude. You aren't bothering anything, but it does give you the opportunity that if you want to make regulations that do deal with public policy, that it gives you an opportunity. Under this, you're disallowed from that. The only thing that you're allowed, rules and regulations in this chapter, are for the internal management only. Does that make sense?
Yeah, again, I have trouble envisioning what the rules would be public policy, but
well, to pass. 25 years ago, they had trouble thinking about a man on the moon, see? Okay?
Plan ahead.
All right. Okay, so we get to the scope of the rules.
There's a new copy of the rules. Jim?
Now, in the rules here, just looking at Rule 4, eligible list. Rule 401.2. Now, is there something in the law that allows, that gives you credit? Is there something in a statute that gives you credit for permanent employment?
No, the statute at 39-25-150, parent 4, says that the rules shall provide for promotions from within the state service where there are qualified candidates in the state service. Vacancies shall be filled by promotion whenever practicable in the best interest of the state. Promotion for competitive examination.
Now do you want a public policy? Here they're giving them points, right? They're giving them points here for being a permanent employee, right? That's public policy. That's what I've been trying to explain to you all along. That is a public policy.
Well, I'm going to have some definitional problems then, quite frankly, because I say from my purview, the statute is the policy that we do, we set up a system that favors promotion from within, and that's what employee credits are for. To give the promotional candidate a leg up. That's been further strengthened in the collective bargaining agreements, of course, by the requirement that we consider.
Well, public, I mean, the collective bargaining agreements are different entirely. That's an agreement between the state and a bargaining unit. But this is what I, this is just a generality is what I was saying is that, I can't believe that this is for the internal management. It would be in a way, and yet it's public policy in a way. Who says that you should? Who in the people in Alaska says that you should give permanent employees more than you should a person just coming on? You do.
Well,
not you personally. You know,
I favor doing away with employee credits. Quite frankly, there's enough other vehicles.
Well, that's the whole thing, but we don't do it because you can adopt this regulation or rule without any even a public hearing. All you do is send it to the personnel board. They nod their head, and it's there. That's it.
That is correct. But again, I would have to construe the policy set by the public as what is enacted by the legislature in providing for promotions from within. How you provide encourage promotion from within is mechanical.
If the legislature wanted you to give points, they would put it in there, just like they did with veterans.
Well, I see where you're coming from.
All right.
I guess the only problem.
I mean, just to get
definitional one. What's public policy? I could broadly construe everything in here to be public policy because in one way or another, it does all impact the taxpayer.
Well,
selection from the top five and so forth.
Federal merit system standards that we have to go by in federal agencies require for promotional credit too, and I don't know exactly how this would cross what we're saying here, but it is part of their merit system principles that promotion. And I'm not sure exactly of every word of it, but do they cross there, Bruce? Do they cross there? I mean, I'm wondering if we're going to foul up the federal agencies by changing some definitions.
No, again, I think the use of points is a mechanical device. You could have other things that, other mechanical devices to accomplish the same end. The rule could require that all promotional candidates be certified first.
Let's not get confused with the individual trees when we're looking at the forest. All I was doing was trying to tell you why I would like to see two different kinds of regulations adopted. One for the internal management of how many coffee cups you got on your desk or something like that, and the rest is when it's really a matter of public policy. And
I think it'd be very difficult to interpret that, though, because people
have
different interpretations.
Yeah, well, you have attorneys that's going to interpret it for you, and that's Attorney General's office.
I think to strengthen your position on this, recruitment examinations, which is Rule 3, Rule 4, eligible list, Rule 5, certification and appointment. All of those rules affect public policy, affect the public. And I think the last Rule 14, General Provisions, would also affect the general public in such a way that they should have the opportunity to be advised of what's happening.
What about Rule 13, too, Prohibition?
How about 9, leave, you know? How about our compensation? How about Rule 10, leave?
Right.
Those are all things that the taxpayer is paying for.
Well, I know, but you get the person on the outside looking in, Bruce, is the way I was looking at it, who doesn't have an opportunity to really understand the system.
I guess, you know, I'm not trying to be covert in our actions. I don't have any problem with the public knowing everything that's going on, but
I
am having a definitional problem with what's public policy versus internal management.
You'll have an attorney that'll tell you that. The whole thing is, speaking for myself, I think that for too many years it's been like a secret society. Nobody knows what the hell's going on outside. Once you're in, you're fine, apparently. But if you're outside, you don't know anything that's going on, and unless you are in a place where you can can make use of you. If you're just a common rank and file employee, half the time you don't know what your rights are or what they aren't. And then they go to APEA and they'll tell you what they are. But not all the time are they right. Most of the time.
99. The point we're trying to get here is if it's something that's public that they have a hearing, perhaps the, now if it goes to the personnel board for a review and it says they may have a hearing, what if we required them to have a mandatory public hearing? And would that solve the problem?
That's the general idea, Lynn. Yeah. That they can have the public hearing in front of the personnel board. There's no yeah. problem with that. I mean, you don't have to make it just like you right. do when you adopt any other regulation. You say you send out notice and say we're going to adopt a regulation.
But if it says May there now, it's not mandatory that they have a public hearing, and maybe that's what we need to be looking at.
Right.
On the personnel board. Rather
How many public hearings have we had on the personnel rules?
Nine.
I can't remember any since I was
Probably not for years, I forget.
Since 72, there probably haven't been any because, for all practical purposes, there haven't been any before the fact rule changes since 72. Everything's been the result of something enacted in a collective bargaining agreement. It's already decided before it ever goes to the board.
Well, let's use as a reference or example the special examination procedures. No, the SEP, that was in existence before, but it just recently became a rule. Think about a year ago.
Right. Oh, no.
Rule, May of 70, Rule 503.
503.
Yeah, that's not SEP.
That's well, not SEP, say. No.
I'm going to have the staff contact the Legislative Affairs or the Attorney General and find out just exactly what, if anything, these personnel rules, what authority they have in law. I'm not so sure they have any.
I don't think they do.
Curious, Bruce, how many people are we talking about for these effect, or is this also kind of the your starting point when maybe you're going in to negotiate the contract?
Well, for purposes of state employees, I guess you could say it is the starting point, although they've been radically departed from some bargaining units.
If we're talking about if it's in a bargaining unit, it's not here, but if it's not mentioned in the bargaining collective bargaining agreement, it is here.
Right.
So by default, it's here.
Right. Because of that, and quite frankly, the absence of the rules and the agreements in the past, the ability that's given the state to prevail in some arbitrations, organizations like APEA have literally got the rules chapter and verse in their contract now. So
what do I do if I'm a state employee and I don't believe in these rules, I think one of them is discriminatory. What happens then?
Well, the thing, if someone is in a collective bargaining unit, the contracts, I think, in all units, at least in the units APEA represents, is set up where the contract is the primary document. And if there's any conflict between the personnel rules and the contract supersedes. If the contract is totally silent on an issue that is covered in the personnel rules, then the personnel rule is the means.
Okay, we got something that the contract is silent on, but it's a rule that somebody, that Bruce has made.
For openers, I can't make
them. I know you can't.
First, if it's a question of interpretation of the rules provide that they can appeal any interpretation I make to the board. If it's an out-and-out disagreement with a rule, you know, they just feel it's a bad rule, any employee has the right to petition the board for a change in the rules. You simply write to the board and say, I think this is a bad rule.
And if the board says no, then the recourse is to go hire an attorney, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, somebody's got to manage. And,
sure.
It may not be right from the employee's perspective, but it isn't the employee who manages. I mean, it is, after all, a management system. So somebody got to make the rules. I think it'd be difficult for an employee to sit down and get himself in a situation and try to sort out where the personnel rules apply and where the contract applies.
Well, if I
if I can address it, for all practical purposes, given the volume of turnover that there is in state employment and the length of time that collective bargaining has now been around, for all practical purposes, the majority of the employees no longer know that personnel rules exist. Most of them, unless they've been around for any length of time, has not seen them. They may not even know where they have access to them. They go to their contract first.
So it's not in the contract, it's not dealt with.
Well,
I would imagine it would be their initial. Yeah.
Well, not
it's not covered by the contract, it's
not
too bad.
That it's not dealt with, but that's where they will go first. And there will either, if there's a critical reference that's necessary, the contract will say, blah, 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 and the personnel rules in existence as of X date. Then they know they need to look at a different source, or if they come talk to us, we get the two together in the proper sequence, or what we assume to be the proper sequence. But an employee does not walk around with a personnel rule book, probably has not seen it, and most of them don't even look at it or know that they exist.
In a collective bargaining environment where the employer must have something to bargain, something to discuss, and conversely, the labor organization must have things they want to change or there would be no call for their existence. If an employee has a disagreement with the rule or a practice or anything else, the, I think, commonly accepted manner to deal with it now is to go to your labor organization and say, I don't like this, would you try and fix it? And that's how issues get on the bargaining table, that's how grievances get filed and so forth. And that's just the nature of the collective bargaining process, and as it should be.
Well, this might startle a few of you here, but I'm not all too sure that the collective bargaining isn't going to be amended before too long. Against my best thoughts of it, of course, but I think that it should be obvious to you if you're a bystander, if you're interested at all, that there is a considerable amount of people in the administration and in the present administration at least, and a lot of people in the legislature are getting a little lukewarm about collective bargaining.
Well, no, Senator, I've seen collective bargaining work in the state of Alaska, and I read in the papers and hear it on the radio how it works in other places. And I see policemen on strike, firemen on strike outside. That doesn't happen here.
No, I know, but I'm not telling you my thoughts. What I'm doing is just trying to relate to you some of the possibilities, because we keep saying all the time, well, as long as we have collective bargaining, as long as we have collective bargaining, that's fine. Well, that's good. But I would think that we would want something that we can take up the slack, even if you don't have it.
I can appreciate your concerns and certainly.
Because where are we with our pay raises? God damn it, you see what I'm talking about?
But you can see the hopeless snarl you'd throw an employee back into, you know, in a system like this, whether part of it is subject to administrative code or not. I mean,
right.
It would just be an absolute nightmare, and that's where we were pre-collective bargaining days.
I thought I'd be done with this kind of stuff when I got done with the Liquor Act. I thought I'd be done with that forever. Here I am right back at the same snarls, the same damn thing. Well, I don't have any problem with the rules. Does anybody got any problem with the rules?
Are you looking at section 150?
Yeah.
There are.
Looks like you got everything covered.
Yeah, it's pretty well covered, but again, some of it's inconsistent with collective bargaining. If you look at subparagraph 2, it says no salary or wage payment may be made to a state employee covered by the pay plan unless the payment is in accordance with the chapter and the rules adopted under this chapter. Well, that's not true anymore. Pay plans, most of them are set by collective bargaining. So it should be amended to say or pursuant to a collective bargaining agreement.
Well, Oh, I see what you're talking about.
We've always taken the posture that collective bargaining law, or the results of it, supersede this act, but if we're going to codify, maybe we need to clean some of that small stuff.
Yeah, I should do that. How many employees do we have that aren't covered by collective bargaining?
In the classified service?
In the state.
There's 5 that are covered by the rules in total, and then there's about 400, 500 partially exempt employees who are partially covered by the rules. That's what partially exempt means. Partially covered and partially exempt from.
And what's your argument for partially exempt again now?
Basically, what partially exempt employees are subject to is a classification and pay plan, so that a clerk typist in the governor's office, for example, is rather like a clerk typist in any other office in terms of the work performed, and on the principle of equal pay for equal work should be compensated the same. So that position is lumped together with classified positions for purposes of salary setting, and it carries the same title and so forth. But the incumbent, of course, doesn't have to be appointed off an eligible list, nor does the incumbent have appeal rights terminated. But the partially exempt service is appropriate where you can compare the work with other work, like work, in a classified service and integrate it somehow into the existing pay plan.
Well, partially exempt is and exempt are more or less patronage, right?
Yeah, they certainly can be. They aren't in all cases, but
they were when Hickel was here.
Yeah,
he removed everybody. In fact, I think he even took the coffee pot away and put a new one in.
Yeah, I think certainly there is an example of where there was literally 100% turnover in a partially exempt service on a change of administration, yeah. Which is one of the dangers of too many partially exempt positions. The exempt service is more where you're dealing with really unusual people who either their salary demands are so inordinately high that you can't put them on a salary schedule, or they're only going to be on board for a very short period of time to do a specific project, or the legislature wants to reserve the prerogative to set their salaries, like commissioners, they're exempt, that sort of thing.
What's your classification?
Partially exempt.
Just exempt, they're really unusual, huh?
Yeah.
Write a letter to Hudson saying that Bruce said that he was unusual. One of the unusual.
If you give him the latitude to pay me whatever he wants, I could be in big trouble.
So mainly the exempt service is the pure patronage and except for one or two different ones.
Yeah.
Partially exempt is to allow a latitude of hire while still maintaining a
salary
integrity.
Correct.
And a classified is just a mule.
Classified is salary integrity plus protection, both in selection and in dismissal or termination.
What's the highest range in classified?
Salary range 30.
It goes all the way up there, huh?
Yeah, that got shoved up a couple of years ago. It did stop at 28, now it goes to 30.
Who's up there?
I honestly don't know. I think Director of Public Health, maybe at 30.
It was at 29.
29, something like that. We may not have anybody at 30, but it was getting very compact at 26, because we have classified employees running through ranges 25 now. And directors are 26, most of them.
I still think we should have two. We should have two separate ranges
for directors.
No, just two separate working ranges.
We have had separate schedules in the past for people under collective bargaining agreement and those who are not.
No, what I'm thinking of is a Oh. Where a guy comes out of school and he's got a degree, and they don't want to put him under somebody that doesn't have a degree, and that person is kept there in one spot all the time. Well, it used to be around level 16. You could never get higher than that. What's the word when you go to school, they got the vocational. They should have one vocational deal and the other.
An apprentice, journeyman type thing?
Well, so the people there that are.
The career ladder thing where you've got.
Yeah, they have two different ones. And when you bring a guy from out of school and he has no. Really value to you, except that he can understand a little bit faster than somebody else. But then you put him ahead because of his educational qualities. You put him ahead of somebody that's been working for the state for 15 years.
We try to eliminate that whenever possible.
But it doesn't work.
Keeping the MQs really minimal. Well, I can't tell people who to hire.
No, I know that.
Promote, but.
But you understand what I'm talking about? I have two, there's people I'm sure that don't have a level of education that's required by the tests and that are more valuable to the state than some people that can meet to express the buzzwords and all the rest of it, and they get a big job.
I think
that's just okay. A personal idea.
Yeah. What I'm thinking is that...
He said it all. Sergeant, lieutenant,
if they're doing the same kind of work and you try and establish two different salary schedules, you're going to get crossways with both state and federal law, which basically has you treating everybody exactly the same. And that's why we work so hard to keep the minimum qualifications truly minimal. If you can't demonstrate that they are related to the job and valid requirements for the job, they're unlawful.
No, you're missing what I'm saying. No. What I'm talking about is compaction of the pay schedules. Because all of a sudden you get a compaction in there and you say, well, this guy, you can't pay a guy that doesn't have a college degree more than there, then you're going to pay this guy for the simple reason that the qualities, we've asked that these qualifications in experience, or not in experience, but in education, rule.
But all of them have substitutions.
Yeah, but that shouldn't happen anymore.
Yeah, it shouldn't happen.
And in fact, I can, by name, I can show you lots of cases where the non-degree person is at a higher salary range, much higher, and supervises people with degrees, if their practical work experience enables them to do the job.
Well, I haven't had too much educational experience, but I have a lot of practical experience, and I've looked at some of those tests, and whoever make out those tests, must have their head in the air someplace, because they...
Somewhere.
I almost said something bad, and it just slipped right out.
We already know what you're thinking.
That is a whole other problem that faces the state of Alaska. It's a very serious one that disturbs me greatly. Most of those tests are remnants of testing practices in the 50s and 60s, where you bought them off a shelf from national testing firms that, the same test was used across the nation for accountant and so forth. And this was before much of the law that required you to prove that those tests were valid predictors of ability to perform. That's where most of the state's tests came from, just like every other jurisdiction. In 72, aside from just good business, there were some legal requirements put on us to validate things. And starting in 76, we established a test validation unit. But it's only three people, and the validation requirements are very stringent. We're lucky to get five a year done. And right now, I don't think I have 15 tests that would stand up in court. And to give you an example of just the situation you're talking about, Senator, we had an accountant over in the Division of Finance who they wanted to promote, a real hotshot performer. The guy did not have a college degree, but they thought the world of him. And he took the accountant test five times and failed it, five different times. In the meantime, we were doing a validation study coming up with our own test for the new accounting series, which was ultimately implemented. This guy took that new test, which we statistically proved to be job-related, and he was the number one scorer on that new test. And that kind of thing really scares me.
Well, another thing that bothers me is the agencies we'll ask the legislature for, we'll say an accountant five, and they keep them, and they need an accountant five. And then all of a sudden they readjust their schedule, and they don't need an accountant five, but they ask for it each time. And they fill it, they fill a guy, but his duties slowly get away from accounting until he sits there and runs a machine all day long. Okay, then all of a sudden something comes around. This guy's been working there maybe for 10 years, doing the same thing, and his rating is an accountant five. And maybe the program is changed. They reprogram the whole thing, and then they put this guy in a different section. He can't do an accountant five's work. See?
Correct.
So I think that, I know it would be a tough thing to do, but I think that if we could get into the agencies and go through a desk survey and just see exactly what the people are doing and reclassify them if necessary, so that the jobs are at least pertinent to what their classification is.
The theory is wonderful, and I'd love to do that. Logistically, it's impossible with my staff, even when I'm fully staffed.
Oh, sure, I understand.
Six classifiers. The best thing I think that's happened as far as impropriety and classification are the clauses in the collective bargaining agreement, which allows the employee, to generate and, in fact, insist upon an audit of his job if he feels it's out of whack. And an employee who's reasonably astute, if he's worried about things like that, slowly being phased out of the accountant field, will ask that his job be examined. That's not to say everyone will do it. Some of them may be very comfortable pulling the lever and hoping that nobody ever looks at them, because they're probably getting overpaid for pulling the lever, and they know it.
Well, I don't know. The one case that I had in mind is Margaret Clark. I think it was Margaret Clark.
Huh? It's a familiar
She worked for the public safety. In fact, she was doing whatever her job was, but it was mislabeled. And See, well, how come these things happen? And all of a sudden, you guys say, "Well, you have to take a test." And she's been working a job for 15 years, doing a satisfactory job in the classification where she's at. And then through a legislative or a reorganizational attempt by the department, and they cut down the classification to another drop to something else. And here's this poor woman; she's out. Now it would seem to me that your requirement for those people to go back and have to take a test over again, that doesn't fit.
Well, she got caught up in the revision of the accounting series I'm just talking about, too. If she had been laid off from a higher-level job, she would still have layoff rights to that level. But that's not what happened in her case.
They eliminated the job.
Right.
They eliminated the classification, and she's out.
That's right. There was nothing to have layoff rights from when they got done. And really, there's very little that... That's program management, and there's very little that my division can do to curtail that. I can't tell them how to direct their employees to work, what to make them do.
Yeah, I know, but I mean, just to say it's somebody else's job, that's part of our job, is to see if we can eliminate something like that. How it would seem to me that, and I know the woman personally, she used to live here, and she seemed to me an ordinary lady that was doing the job, 15 years done the job. And then all of a sudden some guy comes in, wants to reorganize, she's out. Now, you're talking about merit system and keeping people in work happy and that. How do you keep somebody like that happy?
But Senator, the legislature does this too. They cut out specific positions, and the person might have been in them for years doing a satisfactory job, and yet, you know, they're out in the cold too.
Sometimes they aim at a specific.
No, you don't, but. Some members of the legislature.
Sometimes very express.
Sometimes they should.
There's a lot of times I would like to eliminate one or two.
That employee probably doesn't think so. No. I mean, it's a matter of perception. And I'm certainly not going to argue that bad management doesn't occur under a merit system. It does, in fact.
Now, it would seem to me, though, that if a person is qualified Why would they have to, if I'm in a job in an accountant five, and I've worked at that accountant five job for 10 years, is there any time that you come to me and say, you have to take the accountant five test over again to see if you're qualified?
No.
Well, that's the whole thing. You stay right in your job, and you could be there 55 years.
But there weren't any accountant fives. I mean, that was...
I'm just using that as a figure.
If the accountant five class had remained, she wouldn't have had to be tested. But she was going into things that were ostensibly different than anything she'd ever been in before, which is why she had to be retested. That job that she held...
Your answer is asinine, Bruce. All you're doing is just talking about... The poor lady, get her out of the way and we'll forget
her. There are no such thing as accountant fives.
Let's take the other side of this issue now. We've got a situation where you take an employee who is sitting in a position which is upgraded. And that rule that I just showed you a couple minutes ago, rule 301.22, says that an employee of record who holds permanent status in a position which has been reallocated to a higher class shall be admitted to examination for the higher class if he meets the minimum qualifications for the class and has already acquired a place on the eligible list for the class. But isn't there another part to that rule that allows that person to just become an accountant?
Yes.
Six or whatever.
503.1.
Automatic. Maybe I looked at the wrong one. But anyway. My point is that if he's an incumbent in the position, the position is upgraded.
50213.
The person then gets to be at that higher level without ever taking a test or being examined in any other way. Now, when we take the other side of it and we remove a person from the position because they're reclassifying it for some other purpose, we don't have any way to take care of that person.
Well, no, we do. The person can go with the position. I mean.
But you abolished the position in this Mrs. Clark's case?
No. No. The old classification of accountant five was abolished, okay? Her position remained intact, and she could, in fact, stay with the position.
It remained intact, but at a what?
I forget the specifics, but it was at a lower level. Okay, so the best she could get would be the step placement on demotion or a frozen salary, and I don't recall what her particular circumstances are, but the position ended up being at a lower level. She wasn't booted out of a job, per se.
Okay, but my point comes back to the examination part of that.
She didn't have to get examined for the lower level, Don. Okay, she had an automatic entitlement to that.
Okay, but to what did she have to get an examination? There were different classes she was applying for?
What she was in no longer exists, and what we now have is accounting supervisor 1 through 5, which are defined differently than the old accountants.
Okay, but that's my point right there. You take a position and you upgrade it, and the incumbent in that position gets the position, regardless of what his background or anything else is, right?
Right.
Okay.
That's a specific position, a job.
Well, why can't you, to take care of a person who's been employed for 15 years or 10 or whatever, you've got some kind of a,
Don, what happens when a position is downgraded? What happens to the employee in that position? What do we do with them? They go to the step in the lower salary range that preserves their salary, or they get red circled. Their salary is frozen at the higher level. We don't throw them out of a job. We don't give them a cut in pay. You know, the system really works to protect those people too. This Mrs. Clark's problem was, and I'm not putting down her problem, but it was an ego problem. She wanted to get back up at the higher level, which the former higher level no longer existed. But she wanted to get back up at the higher level. We now have statistically proven valid tests for new classifications, and she had to test at the higher level. She didn't want to take a test. Well, I don't blame her for not wanting to, but everybody who was getting placed at that higher level had to take a test. Everybody. She wasn't thrown out of the job.
Creeping right along here. Jesus. We're going to have to go down through the scope of rules and see if we can't condense them a little bit. It seems like we've got a lot of extraneous talk in here.
again.
It would seem to me that you could bring this down and just say, one is a preparation of a person, of a position, a classification plan, and two, you could get down and say, this is a pay plan, and three, you could get down and say, a selection method, and four, you could say promotion, and five, whatever. But it seemed like that would be a lot better than all the extraneous language that you have in there.
I'm using the fewer words, the more latitude I got.
No, but I mean, it just, you find, unless you need to put something very definitive down, that if you make it in broad language and supplement it with your personnel rules, you're a heck of a lot better off.
Yeah, and a lot of this stuff that's
expensive. Yeah, a lot of it is just
covered by the merit system bill that you had passed right last year, and this was attempting to affect the fine merit principles with the rules.
Right.
Does anybody have any disagreement with that? You're gonna make a classification plan? Okay. You're gonna make a pay plan? That's the scope of the rules. Pay plan, classification plan,
election procedures,
examination plan, whatever.
Well, in general, I don't have any difficulty with what you're saying. Some of it, I think, needs to have, like number two, if you just reference that it will have a pay plan, that's really broad, and I think there are some elements there that you may want to continue to include, such as the reference for like pay for like work, and still shorten it, whatever, rather than
just I don't have any problem with that, but what I mean is just the general idea of modifying it down and condensing it.
Certain critical elements, I think, need to...
I don't have any problem with that. And when you're working with it, you should get somebody from, And if there's any questions that come up, just mark them down, and we'll address those questions individually. Here's our non-permanent appointments, right? Here's veterans' preference. Preference to severely handicapped persons. Voc rehab guy says who's severely handicapped and who isn't, right? Do you have any problem with that? Personnel officers. Let's hear it for the personnel officers.
Did we hear enough the last 2 years for the personnel officers?
No, we heard from them.
From them, not for them. They're still there.
Yeah.
You get to adopt regulations? You people just adopt your own regulations?
No one's exercised any authority to any extent under this law.
Unfortunately.
That's...
Let's hear some more about this.
We may have a philosophical difference now with the director of personnel than we had previously on centralization versus decentralization. The general philosophy before was they wanted to centralize everyone, and we are in fact now decentralizing mass bunches of things. So you might want to talk to Bruce or have Bruce make a comment on that.
I heard that there was a personnel officer at one of the agencies that had more clout than the deputy director. Within the agency itself.
That might be the knows the system better. Could be that he knows the system there and manipulate
that. I know some secretaries.
No, this one had only been working for 6 months. Which brings us back to the location, whether they should be in the department of personnel, division of personnel, or in the individual departments. Would you like to speak on that again, Lynn?
Well, I don't think the position has changed, speaking for the personnel officers, at all for the last several years in that. We believe we're better placed in our own departments for a lot of reasons that are already on the record. I don't think that there is the same kind of push now to centralize personnel officers that may have been around in previous years. And this may not, quote, be a big issue at all. But I'm in a department now where we're actually decentralizing a lot of personnel functions from Bruce's shop to my shop, and I think that it's a very, very realistic way to try and handle the size and the kinds of things that are happening within the personnel system now, given the lack of resources that his department has to provide those functions.
Certainly think for all large departments that okay. It's really essential.
Yeah, and under B, in the last sentence under B, I change that to regulations adopted under this subsection shall relate only to the internal management of the state agency and their adoption. Yeah. Because we don't have personnel officers adopting stuff.
No, actually, I'm troubled by all of subsection B. Philosophically, I favor decentralization. I want the Division of Personnel to be a service agency, not a control agency. You know, we'll provide information, standard tools to work with, and so forth. But as it states in the non-permanent hire law, I like the idea of the agencies taking responsibilities for their actions. I'll give them advice and counsel, but I can't manage for them. But the problem I have with B is in a collective environment, a collective bargaining environment, excuse me, it is extremely important that there be uniformity and consistency in the actions of the agencies. And I would hate to see the agencies promulgating inconsistent regulations from department to department about how things are done.
Well, if the employment is unique, classes are unique. Well, maybe a broad one wouldn't fit everybody.
It's not the classes that concern me. It's internal procedures and requirements. How we do things in Department X as opposed to Department Y.
Wouldn't you though retain a post audit function of the agencies, Bruce?
I've given that a lot of thought. One of the recommendations last year was that Division of Personnel or Division of Legislative Audit annually audit the personnel operations of the departments and report to the legislature. And at first I thought that was a good function for my division. But the more I think about it, the more I prefer to have it be some third party who does the auditing. And again, I provide assistance, guidance, information, advice. But I have trouble seeing people approaching me and trusting me to do that if they feel that I'm the same person who then might turn around and come down their throats if they don't take my advice or decide, you know, in their judgment running a program that something ought to be done differently.
Now, wait a minute, Bruce. So, if you read this, all that they can do, personnel officers, are authorized to adopt regulations for those classes of employees which are unique to the respective departments. So
right.
They can't make broad determination on secretaries or accountants or those kind of people.
Even with, say, fish biologists as opposed to employment security specialists, I think that everybody ought to have uniform lengths of probationary periods and so forth.
Well, those are, yeah, but...
Those, see, what this...
Well, what you want to do is to get language in there that says that they can only make the rules in those areas where these people are different than somebody else's. That's what you're saying? Because certainly leave and all the rest of that, that's an across-the-board deal.
Right.
But if if they can make a rule where a biologist can come to work at 2 o'clock in the morning and work till 10 o'clock or whatever, then who cares about that?
Well, they can do that now. That's provided for. Now, if you look at that third line, Senator, in paragraph B, mm-hmm. it refers back to those activities specified in 150, which is the personnel rules. This section, in effect, gives them the right to make their own personnel rules in certain areas, including classification plans, salary plans, selection methods, promotions from within, establishes eligible lists, certification, periods of probation.
Well, what?
Emergency appointments, non-permanent hires.
Okay, what I would feel...
Couldn't you say not inconsistent with the state personnel?
Yeah.
That you could do. Or not inconsistent with collective bargaining agreements with the personnel.
Well, that's what I meant. Just in those phases where the particular work is unique or different.
Okay, then this language would require modification.
Yeah, we'll do that.
It really gives them some tremendous powers to develop their own personnel rules.
Yeah.
Well, we don't want that.
Senator, no one's exercised that yet, and it does say in here, now I agree with Bruce, a slight modification would be all right. It says subject to the approval of the Director of Personnel in the Department of Administration, so technically none of those things can be done without Bruce's approval anyway.
That's only as to the initial determination of which
you
classes go in,
okay,
not as to the rules.
Okay, not these
things. Not having a problem with that.
Okay.
But then you, once we've decided on that, you have the authority to go out and cut your own personnel models. And I just see all kinds of problems with the state.
I would see them as well.
Regulations.
How could you help?
That are unique subjects as well as unique classes.
Right.
Well, that's it.
By different sections.
Well, I could give them advice and so on and so forth, but they still would have statutory authority to write their own rules.
Well, they might need to go through and say what topics they can.
We got it.
It should be standard.
That's correct.
We got it, and you'll all be surprised.
Oh, yeah, you didn't cross the whole thing out.
Senator, what is the time frame for updating these rules? I mean, how often should they be updated? And, should there be a requirement set so that these things are pulled together periodically and on some time frame? It doesn't call, as near as I can tell, it isn't called out in the...
I think that they should be, certainly somebody within the department should, there's the fox looking at the chickens again, who's going to do it?
Well, it's the Director of Personnel's responsibility.
Well, so he says, yeah, I look to them, they look good.
Uh-huh.
Practically speaking, that won't work. The way they get updated, they are updated massively following the consummation of collective bargaining agreements that affect most employees, like general government supervisory, to be consistent with the contracts. Beyond that, we sort of do
put down a note there as to look into the feasibility of. Well,
when we did the non-permanent bill, we did we looked at them very carefully.
Something like the passage of a new statute, or something declared void, or sort of as needed. I have several proposed changes now that I'm just putting in a folder until I figure it's worthwhile going to the board if we don't need them tomorrow.
Well, this particular set right here had massive changes effective January 16th and then May 16th of 80. So
I've often wondered where that went, and here it is.
What did you find?
Well, this is my bill.
Yeah.
Vocational substitution program.
Contract.
Vocational substitution program. You can thank me for that one.
Nobody uses it.
I know, but they should. Nobody uses that? We'll leave it in there anyway. It looks good.
That's all local 71 jurisdiction,
right,
which has a hiring hall. So.
Right.
Is section G still legal? In this section, resident means a person who has been domiciled in Alaska for at least 1 year immediately before filing his application?
No.
No.
Why, excuse me, Senator, why has no one used this vocational substitution program? Do you think that it's...
It was promised by the then... No, it was promised by the then Director of Personnel in order to... If we wouldn't keep banging at him for making the two levels, vocational and technical, standards, that he would put something in like this so that he could use it in the remote areas.
Well, that's what I was thinking.
That's what you got, and nobody's ever used it.
No, they did. They did. And all the classes still exist. But since the establishment of the Local 71 bargaining unit, which has jurisdiction over this type of work, they've got a hiring hall. There's no minimum qualifications or anything anyway. It's just referral. But it was used, yes.
Oh, we ought to be able to change this around, Jack, some way. Every state employee shall pay to their elected representative or senator X amount of dollars upon demand.
Only if attaining range 25 or better.
Right.
We already do.
We'll pay you for range 25.
Looks like you're going to get, we're going to prosecute you, Bruce. No person may defeat, deceive, or obstruct another person in his right to examination.
Well, I don't defeat, deceive, or obstruct.
You obstruct them. You obstruct them.
That's in his right. I'm actually doing it, I think.
Why shouldn't a person even in the partially exempt service, why shouldn't he resign if he seeks to be elected? I mean, why just the classified?
I always wondered about that. You know, people from the University of Alaska can run and don't have to resign.
Don't have to resign?
It's always been a real enigma to me how... People who are in the university system can.
We don't cover them, John. At least extensively.
No, but I'm just saying. No, but that's really.
Partially exempt employees to run for political office, partisan political office, also have to resign. This speaks to.
Where does it say that?
Partisan public offices and local government.
Rule 13 has some.
Bruce, is this section in conformity to the Federal Hatch Act also? For those agencies that are using federal funds?
Yes, it is in conformance.
This pretty much plugs any potential hole that might exist.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, at one time, and I'm not up on that Federal Hatch Act, but you know, you couldn't even at a local precinct level do that under the Hatch Act. But I know that they've modified that.
Yeah, they've loosened.
What it says here in E, though, is it just talks about classified service, and why shouldn't partially exempt?
I think the merit system or the merit principle requires that political activity be limited.
I think he's technically right. If a partially exempt employee wanted, he'd probably lose his job, but if he wanted to challenge our requirement that they resign, because it's in the context of conflict of interest, you can't carry out your official duties at the same time you're performing as a...
Put that in there. Put partially exempt, and then we know it's covered. Exempt, who cares? They can do whatever they want because they're working anyway. But if they're coming underneath the partially exempt...
Yeah, I think you're right. They could probably challenge the requirement that they resign.
I think
they
could.
Successfully.
this is a pretty loose, and may be heard publicly.
That's been consistently interpreted to mean, although it hasn't been invoked for several years now, that that's their right to be heard publicly. They can insist on it.
Well, if he doesn't want it, I mean, see, we can't change it to shall, because then it means even if he didn't want it, he would have to have a hearing. I think maybe we should put may at his request, but
at his request.
Yeah, shall at their request. Yeah.
Getting back to that 160, you know, in paragraph A, talks about permits appointment, nomination, or election to nonpartisan public office in a local governmental unit. I've heard some concern that some of the local elections are becoming more and more partisan with the establishment of the Libertarian Party, running as a Libertarian Party in local elections, and this kind of a thing, and whether or not eventually this is going to basically force local elections to become partisan elections. And how would that affect this?
As written, then they couldn't run.
So theoretically, then, if you have one person who identifies himself as being a member of a party in an election, a state employee couldn't run for school board or whatever.
Right. Although most of that's governed by statute as far as what are partisan elections. I know the partisan candidates run for nonpartisan offices. Everybody's got some affiliation, even if it's an independent. But I don't think any local government offices are partisan by law. Going back to hearings and appeals, just for your information, Rule 12, which has the details of the hearing procedure, says the hearing shall be closed or open as requested by the employee. And the employee may be represented by counsel if he so desires.
The personnel rule 12.
I was saying our interpretation was that was not the option of the employee. And Rule 12, which lays out the procedures for the hearing, specifically says that it shall be opened or closed as requested by the employee.
Chris, theoretically, this is in here just for those five employees now.
Definitely.
Yeah. None of whom would ever use it anyway.
So this is all covered by collective bargaining other than for those five employees. They have agreements per se.
What if one of the bargaining units kicks out the union and just bargains for themselves?
Then they would come back under the rules.
So we have to have something, see?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Heaven forbid.
That's why we've left all this intact.
Yeah, that's okay. What was I on? I had some state employee was fired and he requested me to be there.
You could have been either on
trial?
The appeal board or as his advocate. The rules allow him to select an advocate on his behalf or an appeal board.
We sure beat the stuffing out of him anyway. Not the guy, but out of the health and social services. Health and social services.
Don't look at me. I don't.
Division of Corrections.
There's Health and Social Services.
They get beaten a lot.
Yeah, they do a lot of dumb things over there.
The guy was.
Now that's uncalled for.
The guy had all good evaluations, and they fired him. And a week later, they put in an evaluation that was a year overdue that he was a bad employee. That didn't make too much sense, did it?
I think it's funny. I had to handle a Van Winkle arbitration with the governor fired him.
Yeah. Okay. Miscellaneous. Well, I don't think we need the A in there, do we?
No, that whole section can actually be. Section.
A, B,
eliminated.
C?
Everything there can go.
It's all gone, isn't it?
Yeah, this strictly applies to the transition period when the rules first went into effect. Status of present employees as of April 19, 1960. State and federal.
You know, we're getting good comments on this non-permanent from some of the other states.
We've got a lot of requests for information from other states.
Yeah. Well, we put it in there. Model legislation, and it was passed by the suggested state legislation committee for the National Committee
Council of State Governments.
Yeah, Council of State Governments.
Sure. I knew we put it in. I didn't know that they...
Well, I told you I went all the way down there in one day and got it passed. You didn't think I was going to leave you alone, did you? I had to go to Kentucky, Tennessee, someplace.
Lexington, Kentucky.
No? No, West Virginia. That's where they had the meeting. West Virginia? No, it was out on a farm. No, I mean, it was...
Riveners around?
Did you drink that?
No, I think they call it, I think they call it some kind of a place. Great big place. No, it's a great big place. And would you believe it? They don't take credit cards.
I believe it.
Did you drink out of fruit jars?
No. No, this was a...
Was it clear?
Where have they got the renovation of the old...
Williamsburg?
Williamsburg, West Virginia. That's where I was. Went down there and got a pass in one day.